The Treasury Secretary weighs in on Congress and health care.
Do they want to help shape this and be part of it, or do they want this country, the United States of America, to go another several decades without doing what every other serious country has done, which is to give their citizens access to basic quality care?
She calls me Mr. Serious. She says I never smile. But if I'd hang around a bit, she'd make it worth my while.
Mr. Serious, Timothy Geithner, suggests on ABC that only silly nations would fail to pass health care reform. The congressional recess brings the Obama team out on the court to push health care. Obama's deep bench tries to come from behind on The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning, everyone. Monday, August 3rd. Call me Mr. Serious. I'm John Hockenberry. Amy Holmes is with us all week, former Senate speechwriter, political analyst. Second week here on The Takeaway. Good morning, Amy.
Thanks for having me back. It's great to be here. And today on the show, we are covering a lot of territory. We'll be talking about what mom and dad, when mom and dad both go to work but still can't pay the bills, what do you do? We're also going to be talking about the new improved GI education bill. And then John McCain takes on baseball and doping. And hey, what's up with Tom Brady's knee?
There's the story.
But first, we have Chris Hayes with us here. He is the Washington, D.C. editor for The Nation magazine and fellow at the New America Foundation. So, Chris, did you hear what I just heard in that Timothy Geithner clip, that if we don't pass the Democratic health care plan, that we're an unserious nation?
Yeah, I did. I'm not sure serious is a really useful adjective in this context, but I do think that his general point is right. There's something deeply dysfunctional and broken about our political institutions if we can't get this done.
Chris, stick around. We're going to continue that conversation. More after the headlines.
And in the headlines, after months of talking health care, the president moves on to the economy this week. That's after Treasury Secretary Tim Geithner, who spoke there at the top of the hour, said Congress has to deal with the ballooning U.S. deficit. The White House says the Cash for Clunkers program will run out of money by today. The Senate is scrambling to add another $2 billion to the popular program, which was scheduled to run out through November. The car makers post their July sales numbers today. Ford says sales are up thanks to Cash for Clunkers. Amy?
Rescue officials in Miami say dozens are injured after a flight from Rio de Janeiro hit severe turbulence early this morning. The Continental Airlines flight was scheduled to land in Houston, but was diverted to Miami after this extreme turbulence. The new head of NATO says his top priority will be the war in Afghanistan and that NATO should negotiate with moderate members of the Taliban. That's after reports this morning that a remote-controlled bomb killed at least two dozen people in western Afghanistan. The Taliban says that they were aiming for a district police chief who's in critical condition.
New GI Bill takes effect today. It offers free in-state tuition for qualifying veterans. It's the first GI benefit package since the 9/11 attacks. The government says the checks are in the mail. Markets closed mostly flat before the weekend, but this morning futures trading suggests a big pop at the open when Wall Street opens in an hour and a half. The Dow opens next hour at 91.72. The S&P starts trading at 9.87, and the NASDAQ begins at 19.79. President Barack Obama officially hit his half-year mark this week. Again, the time when pundits and policy wonks assess his performance thus far. Well, what do you think? On The Takeaway, we want to hear from you. What grade would you give the Obama administration so far? 6 months is a better period to grade this administration than 100 days. What can you do in 100 days? Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE or send an email to mytake@thetakeaway.org.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Star Foundation, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information about the Foundation's digital initiatives at KnightFoundation.org.
You're listening to The Takeaway.
Our government.
Healthcare.
Your government.
The economy.
Bailout.
Global financial recession.
Transportation.
Agenda.
Agenda.
The work that needs to be done.
What's going on?
Good morning, everyone. I'm John Hockenberry here with Amy Holmes. We begin this morning with the agenda segment, what to keep your eye on this week as news headlines advance from Monday through Friday. And joining us, Chris Hayes, Washington, D.C. editor for The Nation magazine and fellow at the New America Foundation, who we spoke with there at the top of the hour. Good morning, Chris.
Good morning, John.
And from our partners in London, the BBC's Martin Plaut, who's the Africa editor. We'll be talking with him from London. Good morning, Martin.
Morning. Hi. How are you?
Let's begin with you, Chris. And here are two cuts of tape which clearly indicate that the Cash for Clunkers program, which went into crisis mode on Friday, is clearly going to be a part of the agenda this week, but not simply because it allows people to trade in their cars and get $4,500 or so for a clunker in return for buying a new one. Listen to Alan Greenspan talking about the response to the program being a larger indicator of what's going on in the U.S. economy.
There is no doubt that that very extraordinary response that we saw is a very important indicator that the state of confidence in the economy is beginning to pick up. If the clunker program had been put in place 6 months ago, it would probably have been a dud.
A leading economic indicator, the Cars for Clunkers program? Well, a Jim DeMint, Republican of South Carolina, would put it a different way.
The federal government went bankrupt in 1 week in the used car business, and now they want to run our health care system. I just think this is a great example of the stupidity that's coming out of Washington right now.
Chris Hayes, is the Cars for Clunkers program going to die this week, and is it an example of brilliance on the part of Washington or stupidity, as Jim DeMint says there?
Well, DeMint's point is kind of a non sequitur. I mean, in terms of Cash for Clunkers and healthcare, in terms of the political fate of the program, I think it's gonna face a much tougher battle in the Senate. It passed a $2 billion extension passed in the House last week by a pretty robust vote. But you're already hearing members of both parties in the Senate raise some concerns about it on the right. And among conservatives, you have this sort of anti-government spending, we shouldn't be in the, quote, used car business argument. And then on the left, among Democrats like Dianne Feinstein, for example, there's some real skepticism about just how much it achieves environmentally in terms of how the contours of the actual trade-in are currently structured.
Is there political risk, Chris, for anyone who would stand up and actually filibuster this? John McCain has suggested he might.
Yeah, I think there is. I mean, there's two things to separate here. Is it effective stimulus policy, and is it effective environmental policy? I think on the first, it's hard to answer anything other than yes. I mean, clearly, the amount of participation, the fact they went through that $1 billion so quickly, shows that there's A, pent-up demand for autos, and B, the money is getting out there quickly, which is the whole idea behind any sort of stimulative spending you do. The bigger question is whether you're actually, reducing emissions by as much as you can or should, and that has yet to be resolved.
All right, we're going to talk about health care in just a moment, but let's bring Martin Plowd in here. The health care debate gets going. Congress is in recess. They're hearing from constituents on health care. Sounds like a perfect time to send Hillary Clinton to Africa to visit seven nations. Martin Plowd, what do you make of this trip?
Well, it's an important trip. You must remember, of course, that President Obama himself was in Ghana only a month ago. Now he sends Hillary Clinton off to go to Kenya, South Africa, Angola, Democratic Republic of Congo, Nigeria, Liberia, and Cape Verde. But, you know, that's a heck of a trip. A lot of countries, a lot of issues. It's going to be very hard to pull it all together.
So is this a bit of a reset button for the Obama administration in terms of our diplomacy with these nations in Africa?
I doubt it. Frankly, first of all, I don't think Africa is that high up the American agenda. President Obama hasn't made a big store of it. I think this is really a question of, trying to take on the many, many different issues that are facing each country. I mean, you take a country like Kenya, you've got the whole question of the post-election violence that happened last year. In South Africa, you've got Jacob Zuma, completely new government, coming in after President Mbeki. Places like Angola, Democratic Republic of Congo, Nigeria, all very important, for example, in terms of oil imports. You've got the Americans now relying, quarter maybe of oil comes from Africa, and yet you also have huge issues of corruption. Well, how are you going to square the two when you want to buy the oil from them, but you want to hit them on the head for their corruption?
And you're not even going to Lagos, where in Nigeria it's really the big issue.
Well, I mean, there is a visit to Nigeria. I mean, even if you're not going to Lagos, how are you going to deal with the big uprising that there was in the north of Nigeria in the last week, where 700, 800, maybe 1,000 people were killed in fighting with the security forces? Is that going to be on the agenda? I very much doubt it.
So, Martin, do you expect in this whirlwind travel that there's going to be actual substantive progress made, or is this mostly symbolic and, there's going to be a lot of follow-on?
I think that there will be some specific issues. For example, in Kenya, there will be a meeting with Sheikh Sharif Sheikh Ahmed, the president of Somalia, and the United States is pledged to provide weapons to his faltering government. To say it's faltering, I mean, the thing's almost on its knees. But, you know, that is absolutely vital that it gets some kind of support. Otherwise, you're going to have a group like al-Shabaab, which is close to al-Qaeda, taking over Somalia. They are in the capital. They are only a few streets which are held by the government. And I think the United States is extremely concerned about this. Of course, you do have troops in Djibouti who could intervene, but I think they are desperate not to have American troops on the ground in Somalia after what happened last time they were there.
And there's also the issue of piracy, correct?
Yeah, but the piracy is frankly nothing that can be addressed on shore, really. I mean, there's nothing that can be done about it at this stage. It's a very, very long-term policy. You have, 20 different nations out there with boats trying to halt the piracy, but they've had absolutely no success. I mean, there was another siege in the last week or so. So they're not getting anywhere in this. But, you know, Africa is a very, very tough place. It was all very well for President Obama to go there and say, you know, development depends on good governance. That's the ingredient that's been missing for so long in so many places, and that's a change that can unlock Africa's potential. But how do you try and bend people's arms and twist their arms, say, you know, you really have to come up to the mark on this, when you have the Chinese there who say, well, we don't care what you do. We're just going to invest and take your minerals. And the African leaders say, whoopee.
Well, the Chinese are all about trade in Africa, that's for sure. The Secretary of State is going to be spending 11 days in Africa. Chris Hayes, doesn't it seem curious that on a very important week on the Iran question, as well as health care, that Hillary Clinton is in Africa dealing with a range of sort of mid-level issues for the next 11 days?
Well, I'm not quite sure. I think that, A, the itineraries of these get sort of set in advance of the political news cycle of the moment. Second of all, what was just said is really crucial from a geostrategic perspective, which is that China really has really expanded its sphere of influence in sub-Saharan Africa. I mean, the U.S. is currently importing 7% of its oil from Angola and around 7%, a little more, from Nigeria. So, you know, there is a strategic imperative on the part of U.S. interests to make sure that they have access to all the kind of mineral resources that are in sub-Saharan Africa. And I think that that's sort of the driving strategic imperative behind the trip.
But what you're saying suggests that Hillary Clinton is going over there with her hand out looking for access to oil and other minerals, whereas the Chinese, as Martin Plaut has just suggested, actually are running the show over there in terms of trade. We're not selling anything in Africa, it sounds like. Martin?
Well, there certainly is a trade with Africa, and I don't think any African would turn around and say that they're not interested in the United States. I think the big problem is, you know, Johnny Carson's the Assistant Secretary of State for African Affairs. You know, he said, I hope the United States is not lecturing anybody. We want to work with these governments. But the problem is a lot of these governments, frankly, if you look at the bottom line, are really, scam merchants. You look at places like the Democratic Republic of Congo, Angola, even Nigeria, you know, people go into government to make money. They don't go into government to serve their people. And this is a very different perspective. How do you deal with a government like that? It's very hard.
All right, last issues before we go. Chris Hayes, Ahmadinejad gets sworn in later on this week. That's going to be a big symbolic move. We'll see what the reaction is from Washington. Sotomayor gets sworn in. That's something quite different, but certainly very, very significant. And finally, unemployment numbers we're going to get on Friday, which are going to indicate more of probably bad news on the economy, Chris.
Yeah, I think that's going to be the key indicator to watch. I mean, the fact of the matter is, from the political perspective, the jobless rate is the driving. If you're going to look at one metric, that's the one to keep your eye on. If unemployment continues, if we continue to hemorrhage jobs, even if the economy has officially stopped its free fall, even if we're even out of recession and growing, if the job loss continues, it's going to be very, very hard for those politicians in power, including and up to Barack Obama, to sell their message, because there's going to be mounting frustration about the direction of the economy.
Chris, that's an interesting point, and it brings me to health care. Will that complicate the efforts in the Senate to make progress on health care? I saw that Hatch in the Hill newspaper just said that the Democratic plan is, quote, out of this world, and he means from outer space.
I'm not sure what Martians do about healthcare coverage, although I imagine they actually have figured out universal coverage. It may complicate, or, you know, if people buy the argument that the president's giving, is that it bolsters the case for it, that in a uncertain future and uncertain economy, people need the guarantee and security of guaranteed healthcare.
Lawmakers are going to be hearing all about it. Chris Hayes and Martin Plowd, thanks so much. That's your agenda. Martin Plowd, BBC Africa editor. Chris Hayes, Washington, D.C. editor for The Nation.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MYTAKE.
869-8253.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, asking what is responsibility in this day and age? Everybody has their own opinion. Discussions and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Big weekend, lots of sports news. Ibrahim Abdul-Mateen, The Takeaway sports contributor, is with us. Ibrahim, let's begin with the good news. We got good news and bad news. Let's begin with the good news, shall we?
Here he's going for three. He's pedaling away, and he is in there with a triple and the cycle. The first one for the Yankees since 1985.
In the last of a four-game series with the Chicago White Sox, Melky Cabrera does what's very unusual in baseball. He hits for the cycle. He gets a single, a double, a triple, and a home run. It was a happy headline there in sports and in baseball over the weekend. What do you make of it?
Well, I have to admit, I actually like New York sports teams, but For the Yankees to go in and beat the Chicago White Sox, they haven't beat any Sox team ever
this season,
Red Sox or the White Sox. So it was definitely big for the Yankees.
It was a great, great emotional story and very exciting if you were there at the game. I wasn't. Wish I was. But
on Mark Burley, too.
There you go. Well, let's talk about the bad news within baseball. This list of players that tested allegedly positive for steroids and performance-enhancing drugs. It was tests conducted by the Players Association. There have been leaks, including last week's leak of Manny Ramirez and David Ortiz having tested positive during the 2003 season. Sure. People in baseball are calling for a release of this list. Where do you stand, and where does baseball stand, do you think?
I was coy about my stance on this, but I think I've taken another tone, and I think right now the list should definitely be released. I think baseball needs to be purged of this, of the rolling sort of release and drip drop of this release that will continue to be a scandal for many years to come if you don't release it at once and just let it be known.
So, Ibrahim, are you saying that you think this is a good PR strategy? That's why you support it?
I think it's much more of like moving past it. You know, I think that baseball has suffered similarly to the United States, to our economy, with lies and cheaters that have used opportunities to get over on other people. Baseball always mirrors larger society. And I think in this instance, we need to move past it, just like we need to move past Bernie Madoff.
Subprime baseball is what you're saying there. Yeah. Well, John McCain, the Senator John McCain, raises the issue over the weekend on CNN State of the Union that maybe we're not talking about the past here. Maybe the release of this list doesn't exclusively talk about what went on before and maybe is an indication of things that may be going on now. Listen to this.
The thing bothers me more than anything else, very briefly, there's someone in a lab somewhere trying to develop a substance that won't be detected by tests. Right. So it's always going to be a game of catch up. But we got to these young people to understand it'll kill them. It'll kill them.
There, Senator McCain is calling for a kind of sea change in the culture of baseball. Do you think we've achieved it in what's already been done to curb performance-enhancing drugs?
I don't think we have. I think cheating and cheaters are only remorseful when they're caught, and I think Senator McCain is correct. So in this particular instance, the people that are going to be hurt the most aren't these big elite players that are going to be good regardless of what they do. It's the guys that are in single A and triple A that are hustling and trying to get up to the big leagues, and they're going to abuse their bodies and kill themselves to get there.
Quickly, emotional news 30 years ago from yesterday, Thurman Munson killed in the plane crash in Ohio. He sort of represents baseball, the old days, that's for sure. But let's talk NFL before we go. Training camp has started. Tom Brady, how's that knee?
Tom Brady's back. He's back in effect, and anyone in the NFL should be afraid. But the big story is that the Vikings quarterback Tavares Jackson went down with a knee injury in practice. defensive lineman rolled over his knee. Mm. Now you wonder what's going to happen with Brett Favre. What's going to happen with Michael Vick? They're two quarterbacks that are on that can be picked up.
Suddenly available, and practice is as brutal as the season in the NFL with the players the size as they are. Ibrahim Abdelmateen, Takeaway Sports contributor, thanks very much. And for more on the steroids controversy, read Baseball's Cheating Heart by Ibrahim at thetakeaway.org.
Well, July was the deadliest month in the 9-year war in Afghanistan.
So hard to believe.
So many Americans don't even, you know, think about this war. It's the forgotten war. And the start of August has already been pretty grim, as we heard from all those headlines. Earlier this morning, we were joined by BBC foreign correspondent in Kabul, Afghanistan, David Lyon. He started out the conversation by telling us the latest news.
Well, it's certainly a very difficult weekend. Six U.S. Troops killed of 9 foreign soldiers altogether. And today, a bomb in the western city of Herat, killing 10 police and 2 civilians. A lot of civilians being caught up in these roadside bombs and suicide bomb attacks when they take place. So July, the bloodiest month, and August looks like it's going to at least have started the same in the lead up to presidential elections later on this month.
So, David, what was the significance of the explosions in western Afghanistan? Why that region?
Well, the real surprise for many people that this has come in Herat. It's a beautiful and ancient town. It's strategically of enormous importance and economically of enormous importance because it's the gateway to Iran on the western border of Afghanistan. And most of the government's revenues come from customs at that port of entry at Herat. So it's a town that they absolutely need to keep a hold of. In recent months, it's been pretty quiet. It's been a place that you would almost think of going as a tourist, but this bomb today has certainly put paid to that as the Taliban have gone out west from Helmand province and Kandahar province and shown that they can extend themselves to Herat.
David Lyon, General McChrystal, commander in Afghanistan, gave an interview to the BBC over the weekend where he suggested that the mission of NATO and coalition forces is to protect the Afghan people, and that suggests there's a difficult balance in using air power to protect coalition forces. Is any suggestion that these casualties may be a result of a change in strategy or tactics?
I don't think this is really connected with that at all, but certainly that has made things different. They call it tactical patience on the ground now, and it means that US and British forces in particular in the south now fighting a very difficult war against the Taliban have to be 100% sure that there are absolutely no civilians anywhere near any bombs that they drop, and it means that they're watching some Taliban insurgents escaping. I have to say it just shows how difficult it is to fight a war in this country. I mean, I recently brought out a book, it's just out in the States, called In Afghanistan, which goes right back over foreign engagement, going back 200 years. You know, the British tried in the 19th century, two wars then, the Russians tried in the 1980s towards the end of the 20th century, and they had more troops than the US-led alliance have got now. They had much better local forces in the 1980s, and still they lost. It's a really difficult country to fight a war in, and I think we're seeing General McChrystal and the new Obama peace plan trying to take a grip on it, but nearly 8 years on, it's very difficult to see whether these new strategies are going to make a big difference.
So, David, really quickly, the presidential elections in Afghanistan are coming up on August 20th. Are those considered to be in any way tied to the spike in violence?
I think the people are really now bracing themselves. International forces have got 20,000 extra troops in to police the country for the elections, and it's going to be a very, very difficult few weeks. The international forces really expecting a long, hot August.
That was BBC foreign correspondent David Lyon. He was joining us earlier this morning from Kabul, Afghanistan.
Coming up, calculating the compensation for veterans and their sacrifices. We talked to a Marine Corps sergeant about the new GI Bill that goes into effect today.
Takeaway is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org, and by the Skoll Foundation, supporting social entrepreneurs around the world. Uncommon heroes dedicated to the common good. Learn more at skoll.org.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual Insurance, offering home, auto, and life insurance products to individuals and families who put a premium on doing the right thing. More information at libertymutual.com or 1-800-4-LIBERTY. Responsibility. What's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway.
I'm Amy Holmes here with John Hockenberry on The Takeaway. Coming up, some pretty important history is being made this morning. The new post-9/11 GI Bill goes into effect. We'll talk to a Marine Corps sergeant about what it means to him. But first, here's a look at some of the news stories we're following this morning.
Well, investors are on pins and needles awaiting results on July auto sales. Ford claims, or is expected to claim, that it got a boost from the Cash for Clunkers program. The Dow futures are way up, so we would expect a positive opening when Wall Street begins trading in about an hour. The White House says the Cash for Clunkers program, which will run out of money today, has been very, very popular. And former Fed Chairman Alan Greenspan told ABC that's a good thing.
There is no doubt that very extraordinary response that we saw is a very important indicator that the state of confidence in the economy is beginning to pick up.
Which may be why the Senate is scrambling to add another $2 billion to the program. It was scheduled to run through November. Rescue officials in Miami say dozens are injured after a flight from Rio hit severe turbulence early this morning. The Continental Airlines flight was scheduled to land in Houston, was diverted to Miami. Four people are in serious condition. Amy?
In Washington, House GOP leader John Boehner is speaking out against a White House plan to create a joint prison and court complex in the U.S. for suspected terrorists. A spokesperson for Boehner called it ill-conceived to bring terrorists into the United States. Meanwhile, overseas, Venezuelan officials are collaborating with Colombia's largest rebel group to help them get weapons and ID cards. That's according to computer records under review by Western intelligence agencies. The new head of NATO says his top priority will be the war in Afghanistan and that NATO should negotiate with moderate members of the Taliban. That's after reports this morning that a remote-controlled bomb killed at least a dozen people in Western Afghanistan. The Taliban says they were aiming for a district police chief who is in critical condition.
Again, we're watching markets and awaiting Ford's news of auto sales in July, expected to be up. And that's some of the stories we're watching today. Amy?
Some pretty important history this morning. Later this morning at 10:30 a.m. at George Mason University, President Obama will be attending a kickoff event for the new post-9/11 GI Bill. So that means that tuition checks are going out today. What's important about this is the first time that the GI Bill covers all tuitions. And with us to discuss this is Marine Corps Sergeant Lance Zoll, who enlisted on September 11th. He just graduated from the College of William and Mary. Lance, thank you so much for joining us this morning.
Morning, Amy. Thanks for having me.
Now, it's my understanding that you didn't use the old GI Bill. You waited so that you could take advantage of this new bill. Was this an easy transition for you to make?
Well, Amy, I did use the old GI Bill. I had attended at William & Mary for 3 years. I used the bill for the first 2 years, and I decided then, once I heard about the new GI Bill that Senator Webb proposed, I did the math, and the new GI Bill is actually going to be twice as valuable as the old GI Bill. So for this reason, I decided to stop using the old GI Bill and save the remaining months to use with the new GI Bill, since I wanted to go to law school, and that would have saved me a lot of money. And since the new bill only covers tuition up to the most expensive public in-state tuition rate, the new bill will only cover so much at the law schools, and it won't cover all private institutions, but it still helps me out a lot. So it's twice as valuable as the OGI bill.
I see. So how did you find out about the new bill? Has the military been pretty aggressive and letting folks know that it's out there, that it was coming down the pike?
Well, I was a student at the time, so I was not in the military. I read about the new bill in the news, and I felt like there was a very good chance that it would pass.
And the military is going to need 21,000 more troops in order to, you know, meet all of our demands around the world. Do you think that this new GI Bill that would cover this tuition, that that'll be a, you know, strong incentive for other folks to sign up?
Yes, I think it would. I think it's a great incentive.
So where can vets go for support in getting this kind of information?
they can go to the Veterans Affairs website. That's a great resource. Also, if they know what university they want to attend, they can contact the university's Veterans Affairs liaison, which is the person who will assist them with registering for the GI Bill.
Well, thank you, Lance, for joining us this morning. We're now going to be talking to a professor of military history who will explain the context of the GI Bill. That's Glenn Altshuler, professor of American Studies at Cornell and author of the GI Bill, The New Deal for Veterans. Glenn, this was a bipartisan bill, and it says something about the government's ability to effect change on a large scale. Every generation has tried to compensate veterans for their sacrifice. How does this one relate historically to what's happened in the past?
Well, there have been many GI bills, Amy. The most generous is the 1944 iconic GI Bill for World War II veterans. Subsequently, GI bills for Korean War, Vietnam, First Gulf War veterans were far less generous. This new GI Bill is not as generous as the first GI Bill, but much more generous than all of the others. The first GI Bill provided up to $500 of tuition, which at that time covered tuition for any university in the United States. The new GI Bill covers tuition at the most expensive public university in the state in which the veteran resides and permits him or her to use that amount for a private tuition, but it won't cover every private tuition in the country.
I see. Well, the original GI Bill, you write, had sweeping implications for American life. It played a role in suburbanization, home ownership, social mobility. What do you expect this new GI Bill is going to accomplish?
This new GI Bill is going to be wonderful for those veterans, and there are 1.8 million of them, of the Iraq and Afghanistan war. Because there were 16 million soldiers in World War II, this bill won't have the great societal impact of that first iconic GI Bill, but it will be an engine of opportunity, I believe, for hundreds of thousands of veterans who will become far more productive members of American society.
Now, it's my understanding, though, that this can be passed down to the GI's children. So do you think that will be impactful?
Soldiers who've had 6 years in and reenlist for another 4 years can pass the benefit on to spouses or children. It's the first time this has ever been done. To date, about 17,000 vets have applied to do that transfer. More than 5,000 of those requests have been approved. So we're not talking about great numbers there, but it means that this provision will be the gift that keeps on giving for perhaps decades to come.
Well, I want to thank you so much for joining us this morning. That was actually Glenn Altshuler, professor of American Studies at Cornell and author of the GI Bill, The New Deal for Veterans. We were also joined this morning by Marine Corps Sergeant Lance Zoll, who enlisted on September 11th. He's just graduated from the College of William & Mary and plans to go to law school. Thank you, gentlemen.
Another lawyer.
What America needs.
That helps it well.
We wish him well.
And it sounds like it wasn't too bad dealing with the veterans bureaucracy to get his benefits. So coming up, two-income households, mad moms, and the division of labor post-kid in families in America. That's coming right up. Stay with us.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway. This is Amy Holmes.
And I'm John Hockenberry. In the beginning moments of Desert Storm in 1991, that's the first Gulf War, one of the first headlines was the loss of Captain Michael Scott Spiker, shot down on the first night of that first Gulf War. He was originally declared missing in action, and for 18 years he's gone from the designation of MIA to KIA to, at a certain point, even believed to have been captured while fighting in that first Desert Storm. Gordon Leubold, Pentagon correspondent with the Christian Science Monitor. The 18-year-old mystery has now finally been solved with the discovery of remains in Iraq. First of all, what's the latest?
Yeah, that's right. They announced early yesterday morning that they had, in fact, found the remains of Scott Spiker, kind of putting finally to rest this 18-year, really enduring mystery that was filled with fits of despair, anxiety, hope, but really this prolonged sense of non-closure for the family and for a lot of people who had just been following this for so long. As you pointed out, the sense that he was his status kept changing over the years, which is fairly rare. I think his status changed 5 times, as you pointed out, missing in action, killed in action.
Well, part of the mystery is the fact that his plane was actually discovered back in 1993, so the question of his remains was a legitimate one.
It was a legitimate question. They found the plane. They found parts of the plane scattered about. They found his flight suit with his name cut out. There were different signs that kind of fueled this mystery that maybe he had in fact survived the crash and had been taken captive by the Iraqis. And then at one point there was even a prison cell found with his initials MSS carved in the side of the wall, which was particularly curious. But that's kind of the most interesting thing about this thing is that really there are still these questions that remain, even though the mystery essentially has been solved.
Well, the grim, sad details that emerged over the weekend, apparently some Bedouin had buried this body. A man in Iraq had heard about it, passed that information to U.S. authorities, and the remains were actually sent to Dover Air Force Base, where it was a DNA and dental match, and also some visual evidence.
That's right. I mean, one of the things that was one of my questions was, why did it take so long? But as you know, Bedouins move around a lot. And so these Bedouins apparently came upon the crash site at the time, saw his body, and out of respect for their own culture, buried it immediately, and then wandered off and never really to be heard from again until early last month when this Iraqi remembered talking to them and they started to put the dots together.
Gordon, this is Amy here. This news must be a great relief to his family. How have they reacted?
Well, they've really, as I say, endured these ups and downs. His wife had remarried, actually, one of his best friends, another naval officer, and they had tried to move on. But his kids, who were, maybe 2 and 3 or so when this first happened,
wow,
now in college, they just really were looking for a sense of closure, obviously. I think that they knew that this was probably the answer they'd get ultimately. I think they'd given up hope that he was still somewhere around Iraq. But to actually have it happen,
right,
and have him find it was,
Well, there's no way even the inevitable doesn't, blunt the poignancy of the moment. Gordon Lubold, Pentagon correspondent with the Christian Science Monitor. Thank you so much.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, examining the practice of renting dogs to people who desire canine companionship when visiting a new city. Who does it really comfort, and who does it exploit? Discussions and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning, everyone. I'm John Hockenberry. Coming up in just a minute, some disturbing family arithmetic in two-income households. One breadwinner plus one breadwinner may mean one angry mob. It's an economic indicator. We'll talk about it in just a moment. But first, some of the news stories we're following this morning.
Rescue officials in Miami say dozens are injured after a flight from Rio de Janeiro hit severe turbulence early this morning. The Continental Airlines flight was scheduled to land in Houston, but was diverted to Miami. Even if the world is successful in cutting carbon emissions, the state of California needs to start preparing for rising sea levels and hotter weather. That's the conclusion of new state reports that recommend communities rethink future development in low-lying areas and conserve water supplies. John?
The new head of NATO says his top priority will be the war in in Afghanistan, the former Danish prime minister says that NATO should negotiate with moderate members of the Taliban. In China, police have detained an additional 319 people suspected of being involved in ethnic unrest last month. That's according to state-run news agencies. In Beijing, police have detained hundreds of others suspected of being involved in the conflict between the Han Chinese and the Uyghurs. Authorities say only a small number will actually stand trial. Meanwhile, in China's rural west, a remote village has been sealed off after a second person died from the pneumonic plague. Pneumonic plague is closely related to bubonic plague, which killed millions in the 1300s, but it spread through the air by coughing.
That's a look at some of the stories that we're watching for you today.
So on Monday, we try very hard to get a conversation going around the family table, family issues, possibly work issues. It's a tough time for families in this economic environment. You know, there was a time not too long ago when the emergence of the two-income household, moms and dads working, was seen as something of a triumph for gender equality. I know when my mom went to work, it was a big deal in our family. But maybe it put a little more cash in the family piggy bank. But these days, a two-income house struggles just as hard to make ends meet as any household. It doesn't matter if you have two incomes, you're still struggling. And it turns out that many moms are getting mad about all this. It's a division of labor issue. Mad moms. Joining us to talk about mad moms as something of an economic or sociological indicator is our friend Jeremy Adam Smith, author of the new book, Daddy Shift: How Stay-at-Home Dads, Breadwinning Moms, and Shared Parenting Are Transforming the American Family. And also joining us, regular Takeaway contributor Lisa Belkin. Lisa writes the New York Times parenting blog, Motherload. Lisa, Jeremy, good morning.
Good morning.
First of all, Jeremy, what evidence is there that moms are mad, and does it just have to do with the money problems?
Well, most recently in January, Parenting Magazine released a poll that showed that quite a few mothers were pretty fed up with their husbands. You know, for example, 40% said they're mad at dad because he can't seem to multitask, which is a kind of essential parenting skill. 30% said they can't get enough help with chores. Although what I think is interesting about the survey is that it also shows that if 30% say they don't get enough help with chores, 70% say they are getting enough help, or at least that they're satisfied with the division of labor.
The glass is more than half full. Is that what you're trying to say there?
That's right. Well, I would actually say that that's the real source of the anger, is that, you know, when families are surrounded by seemingly positive examples, and the grass looks greener on the other side, and, you know, dads, the mom is measuring the dad against other dads, and the dad is measuring himself against other dads, then that can create a lot of feelings of inadequacy and anger.
Well, that's an interesting theory. Lisa, as a wife and mother, first of all, do you think you've got a raw deal here, and are other women sharing that opinion?
Oh, I hear from the other women a lot. And actually, I think the measuring thing is right, but I would phrase it a little differently, which is I think that women are measuring themselves against both their mothers and their fathers. They're doing their mom's job and they're doing dad's job. If they're working outside the home and bringing in an income, they're their fathers. And then they come home and they feel this obligation to be their old-fashioned mother, who may or may not have ever really existed, and bake cookies. And then you've got dad, who's comparing himself to his dad, and he's feeling pretty good about it. But mom's looking over at him and saying, yeah, and I'm still chasing two role models here. And there is. There's a lot of anger. If any time I write about this on the blog, things pop. People complain.
I wonder if that's an argument for this being a statistical anomaly, maybe something of a transition for this generation, and that younger women are going to less be comparing themselves to these unachievable role models, and that things are moving towards a kind of an equaling out in the sense of anger.
I think there is definitely a change already happening. I think part of it is there's been this wave of complaining, legitimate some of it just sort of got out of control, and it was listened to. I think that men got that women felt overwhelmed. I also think that people like Jeremy came along and started saying, yeah, but we have a point of view too. Here's how it looks from the male side. We are also struggling with this, and that, interestingly, is the conversation I'm starting to hear more of very recently.
So sensitive, Jeremy. Get a little of some of these numbers, okay? 46% of moms get irate with their husbands once a week or more, okay? Yeah. Lots of moms.
Really,
I know. 40% are angry that their husbands seem clueless about the best way to take care of kids. And 40% of moms, you sort of alluded to this, are mad that dad can't multitask. Yikes. Yeah.
Well, you know, so yes, absolutely. That is an issue. And, you know, the more I learn about human psychology, the more I think it's a miracle that we ever see eye to eye on anything.
Well, and the more you learn about human psychology, it comes from your laboratory at home, right?
Yes. Yeah, and also the laboratory where I work. I work at the UC Berkeley Greater Good Science Center in the Child Study Center. And, you know, I spend a lot of time talking with psychologists about this. And, you know, I think what really happens in a lot of homes is that, and this certainly happened in my home, you know, a couple of years ago, my wife and I started to develop, I think, a lot of conflict. And what happened, and one of the things I learned is that this is typical. After people become parents, conflict shoots way up. You know, a number of studies have found that about two-thirds of couples during the first 5 years of their child's life will experience more conflict than they did before. And in my family's case, and I think this is true for a lot of families, what really started to happen was that both my wife and I were working, and we were both feeling a lot of pressures and demands on our time, and empathy between us really started to break down. And I think that, you know,
let me just unpack that a little bit. Mm-hmm. Empathy broke down in the sense that you both were sort of silently feeling unappreciated together, but independently.
Oh, yeah. And, you know, when you become a parent, it becomes very hard to talk about serious issues that you're facing as a couple, because especially if you're working parents, because you're either at work or you're at home with the child and you're not discussing these things with the child. And then it becomes very important for couples to set aside time for themselves as a couple, as romantic partners and as life partners, and talk and, you know, and also talk and talk about the serious things, but also talk about right. the good things and make time for themselves.
Well, Lisa Belkin, take us out with the idea that maybe on Motherload, your blog, there are some insights being shared by women and couples on how to actually do this, to get back to the empathy once you've entered this conflict zone when the kids arrive.
Well, I have great faith in the next generation, which is talking about things like equally shared parenting.
Giving up on us, huh?
Well, on me, yeah. But the idea that you can share everything, that, you know, everyone is entitled to an equal share of the childcare, yes, and the housework, yes, and bringing in the income, yes, but also personal time, you know, relaxation time, that this is both spouses, both parents' responsibility. And at least in polls and on paper and theoretically, this generation says that that's what they're seeking. It'll be interesting to see what happens when, you know, reality catches up with the theory.
Well, in the it'll be interesting department for both of you, my family's about to get a great test. My wife is due with our fifth child in December.
Congratulations.
But our second set of twins is 8 years old. Our first set of twins is 11. So it's been 8 years since we last did this together. First time, I think I have no memory of it. We were on autopilot. Second time, I think we tried to get a little better. This is going to be a real test of our ability to share. Any insight and any advice, Lisa and Jeremy?
Oh, you've got your own laboratory going on there.
I know, exactly.
I think you need to come on once a week and report about it.
I need to get an NSF grant. Jeremy, give us the last word.
Well, division of labor is very important, but a lot of studies by Arlie Hochschild and Angela Trethewey and other researchers have found that just as important is expressing gratitude for what your partner does and cultivating an attitude of gratitude in your home. And when you do that, couples tend to be a lot happier, individuals are happier, and the relationships tend to last longer. And also, I think it's good for the kids.
Oh, well, let's get that started. Honey, I am so grateful for what you're going through right now. We're going to take some pretty good data in our family, I think. Jeremy Adam Smith, author of the new book, Daddy Shift, How Stay-at-Home Dads, Breadwinning Moms, and Shared Parenting Are Transforming the American Family. And friend and regular Takeaway contributor, Lisa Belkin. Lisa writes the New York Times parenting blog, Motherload. Thanks to you both.
Well, John, I think we need to get your kids in here to get their perspective.
That's a whole new radio show.
Well, speaking of marriage, President Barack Obama just celebrated his six-month anniversary as president. But is the honeymoon over, or is it too soon to tell? Here's one view from Joe in Atlanta.
You know, it's only been 6 months. I think the media, including this program, has been very unfair to Obama. I'm not the biggest Obama supporter, but I think we gave George Bush 8 years to get us into this mess. I don't think there's been enough time for somebody to turn anything around.
Takeaway listeners, we want to know what you think. How do you think the administration is doing? Tell us at 877-8-MY-TAKE or send us an email to mytake@thetakeaway.org.
Give him another 6 months, or what do you think?
Well, I think he gets 4 whole years, actually.
The listener actually, yeah, he does get 4. He definitely does by the Constitution. Right. I'm John Hockenberry.
I'm Amy Holmes, and this is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org and by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is The Takeaway.
Creeping missions, keeping who out of harm's way?
We're here to protect the Afghan people, and we're here to protect them from everything that can hurt them, both enemy activity but also inadvertent activity by Afghan forces or ours.
As the worst month of coalition casualties ends, commander of U.S. forces in Afghanistan, General Stanley McChrystal, tells the BBC that the mission in Afghanistan is to protect the Afghan people, in part, from the coalition. Obama's missions, how many of them are creeping? 6 months after the inauguration, the slow pace of change we need. Creepy crawlers on The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning, listeners. It's Monday, August 3rd. I'm Amy Holmes, in all week with John Hockenberry. Great to be with you.
Good morning again, Amy. A second week on the show today. I look at the mission in Afghanistan, the growing tensions in hardline Iran. Mozart, it turns out, is even more prolific than we thought. That will depress all of us. And America, take a vacation, you workaholics. Come on. But first, my old buddy, voter, artist Pat Gallagher in Louisville, Kentucky. Pat, good morning.
Good morning.
You went from George W. Bush supporter to voting for Barack Obama back during the campaign. Now,
yes.
6 months into the Obama administration, are you holding steady, Pat, or are you looking for yet another political home now?
You know what? I think I'm looking for another political home.
Get out!
I got it. You know, in looking at this, under George W. Bush, I felt his reign was of political fear. But at least at that time, I was selling 5 or 6 pieces of artwork a week. Now people are so scared, honestly, of the future, their economy. This administration does not want to waste a good tragedy with our economy that everybody is terrified to spend money.
Huh.
And
well,
obviously, the first thing to go is artwork.
Pat Gallagher, starving artist, economic indicator. Stay with us. We'll continue the conversation 6 months into the Obama administration in just a few moments. But first, everything you need to know in the news. The president is off of health care. That's in the headlines. And on to the economy this week after Treasury Secretary Timothy Geithner said Congress has to deal with the ballooning U.S. deficit. The Cash for Clunkers program is about to be a clunker itself. The White House says it runs out of money today. The Senate is scrambling to add more cash to the billion-dollar program. And reports out this morning are expected to show that the rebate boosted auto sales. Carmakers post their July sales numbers today already. Ford has said sales were up because of the program. Amy?
Some difficult news this morning. Rescue officials say dozens are injured after a flight hit severe turbulence on its way from Brazil to Texas. The Continental Airlines flight was diverted to Miami. 4 people are in serious condition. The new head of NATO says his top priority will be the war in Afghanistan and that NATO should negotiate with moderate members of the Taliban. That's after a remote-controlled bomb killed at least a dozen people in western Afghanistan today. The Taliban says they were aiming for a district police chief who's in critical condition now.
Markets mostly flat when they close for the weekend. The Dow opens at 9172. The S&P starts trading at 987. And the NASDAQ begins at 1979. Futures trading still up. Looks like a positive opening on Wall Street in about a half an hour. So all the missions of the Obama administration. We talked about Afghanistan there at the top, but there are all sorts of missions of this administration. And 6 months in, what do you think? How are they doing? Are you drifting away from Obama or are you sticking with him? We're going to talk to some voters in just a second. 877-8-MY-TAKE. We want to hear from you. MyTake at thetakeaway.org.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Star Foundation, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information about the Foundation's digital initiatives at knightfoundation.org.
You're listening to The Takeaway.
Good morning, everyone. John Hockenberry here with Amy Holmes. And last week was pretty successful hosting for you. You're here for another week.
Well, thank you. It was
We're
going to
give you a really hard job today.
Okay.
Yeah,
I'm ready.
You got a piece of paper over there?
I got a paper.
Right.
I got a pen.
Great. We're going to have you sketch out a scorecard for the administration.
A scorecard?
All right. It's probably not going to be terribly definitive, but we want you to take some data.
Okay.
All right?
Is this going to take real calculus here?
Well, arithmetic. Let's just put it that way. 6 months into the Obama administration, it seems to me you suddenly get a sense of the challenges ahead for this administration. 100 days, that's sort of a silly milestone. 6 months, you begin to think that maybe there's something worth talking about. And again, we spoke at the top of the hour about all the missions of this administration, Afghanistan, healthcare, the deal with the economy. We're going to get a scorecard for some voters now, and I want you to keep track of the data here. All right? Joining us first is Brian Hinkle, 24-year-old McCain voter from Illinois. Actually, you live not far from Barack Obama's old neighborhood. Am I right on that, Brian?
Up until about a month ago, yes, but I just moved up to the north side of the city.
So you're a North Sider now.
That's correct.
That's great. All right. So, Brian, are you feeling good about your vote for John McCain? And how would you grade the Obama administration 6 months in?
Well, I was never particularly ecstatic about John McCain, but I certainly don't regret voting for him, especially seeing how the administration has shaped up so far. I would grade Obama B-minus so far with a negative outlook.
All right. Getting away from the grades for a moment, let's do this a little more pass-fail. Are you drifting away from Barack Obama? Are you holding steady, or are you, just on the fence completely?
I have never really been on the fence or in favor of Obama, so I'm not sure that's a fair judgment. I'd say as far as an expectation of him being thought well and an expectation of the success of his policies, definitely less likely to work out now than, say, 3 months ago.
All right, so a B-minus there from Brian Hinkle. Mark that down, Amy. And he's not moving away, so that's sort of positive. And he never was with Barack Obama there, so maybe it's not a net loss for the administration. But joining us now is Tracy Rousey, who was an Obama supporter who voted for him in Alberton, Georgia. Tracy, are you there?
Yes.
So 6 months into the administration, how are you feeling?
I feel pretty good. I'd say an A-minus. I'm pretty progressive, so I got a father that's on city council. My husband was on the Board of Education, so I realized you got to do a lot of compromising when you're elected to office to get things done. And I think he's tried really hard, very hard to do that. And I'm pleased with him. He's had a lot on his plate, a lot.
Well,
I think he's done a very good job.
That's certainly true. Now, Tracy Rousey, you describe yourself as a progressive, right?
Right.
I would think a progressive might be a little concerned about the course of this administration. It seems on health care, the progressives are getting left in the lurch. It's the blue dog Democrats that are getting most of the attention from the Obama administration. How are you feeling about that?
Well, I'm upset. I'm upset about that because I want the public option at the very least. You know, I think the one-payer system would have been better all the way around, but we need that public option. But I got a husband and a father in politics, or my husband just come off the Board of Education, and you got to compromise to get things done.
Well, you come by it rightly. Let's just review the bidding there for a second. You support single payer and a national health care system, and it concerns you that the Obama administration seems to be moving away from that. Are you moving away from Obama, or are you holding steady?
I'm with him.
All right. Mark that down, Amy, as a holding steady.
Holding steady.
All right. Alice Kraft Kearney, are you there?
Yes, I am.
In New Orleans, Louisiana, executive director of the Lower Ninth Ward Health Center in New Orleans, an Obama voter. Are you holding steady or are you drifting a little bit, Alice?
Holding steady, absolutely, because I feel that Obama is bringing forth a lot of the ideas and a lot of the things that we have wanted to be brought forth, especially in healthcare, which is the area that I work in, which is increasing access, looking at the total outcomes of the patient. We want positive outcomes. We don't want folks just to go to the doctor and be seen, but actually have good results. And we want to see an increase in electronic medical records, because that was one of the big things that happened in New Orleans. Folks left. There was no possible way to get their medical records. If we had everything done electronically, that the records would have been able to go with the patient. And also here in Louisiana, we're trying to reform our Medicaid system, which is so far, I guess it's such an archaic system. So hoping that Obama will be able to somehow increase access, whether it's private. I know that's going to be, as the lady said before, there's going to be a lot of compromise.
Yeah.
So I think initially we're going to see private, even though I favor one payer.
Well, it's the hope part. It's the hope part that's the key there.
So, Alice, you're down there in the lower ninth ward, and you're involved in the big reconstruction effort, you know, Herculean reconstruction effort. Is the stimulus money hitting the streets? Are you seeing results?
Not in our area. We've historically been left behind, and we're still being left behind. What's happening is what we've seen is a diversion of the money from the areas that need it the most. And all I can say is that even though the people of the United States wanted that money to come to us, it has not really touched the people who need it the most.
Well, Alice, let's focus a question on that then. Does the Obama administration get another 6 months from you? You say you're hoping for changes on health care, haven't really seen them yet, but maybe, and hoping for that stimulus money to be spent properly.
You can't blame Obama. He's only been in there for a few months. We're still living off of the funding from the previous, which was the bright spot. The health care piece was a bright spot in the Bush administration for us.
All right. Sounds like she's holding steady.
Holding steady.
All right, Pat.
But real quick, I need to find out. Alice, what's your grade for him?
I would say at least a B.
B.
I feel like he's
lower
putting
than
in
Tracy.
A great effort.
Yeah.
The thing is, you have to look at what's actually touching the people. And even though we could have the best hopes, if it doesn't reach the people, if the action doesn't reach the people, you still have a long way to go.
All right.
And we want it to reach the people.
Alice Craft Kearney is Executive Director of the Lois Ninth Ward Health Center in New Orleans. We've also talked with Tracy Rousey from Alberton, Georgia, and Brian Hinkle right at the top there, a McCain voter from Chicago, Illinois. Pat Gallagher, at the top of the hour, you described yourself as a starving artist, and you're blaming Barack Obama for that and are looking for a new political home. What would you grade his first 6 months?
First 6 months, you know what? He's shown himself to be no different than every other politician.
Whoa! That sounds like a
except
D.
He is very good at telling you what you want to hear. As Goldman Sachs records their highest profits in history, the average person in this country is afraid to spend money because we're on the abyss of a financial crisis.
So what's your score for Barack Obama? What's your grade for the first 6 months?
He's like every other politician. He just says it better.
So it sounds like you've definitely fallen out of love with Obama. The honeymoon is over.
Well, with the lack of transparency that he promised and everything else that he promised just falling by the wayside, it's hard. I think he's a good man. He's just a politician.
Now, I've seen some of your work. You were kind of a realist painter there, painting pictures during the campaign, particularly of Michelle Obama. Are you maybe shifting to a post-impressionist, a kind of expressionist, maybe a little darker kind of, you know, de Kooning sort of motif here?
You know what? I definitely see my work shifting, and I don't know if I can blame Obama for that, but I think our country is in a crisis now, and that may be the reason for it.
All right. Pat Gallagher, Obama voter, registered GOP.
Hey, go to patgallagher.org, by the way.
Yeah.
I need all the help I can get.
It is America. It is America, after all. Pat Gallagher, Obama voter, God. Registered GOP, but was a supporter in 2004 of George W. Bush. Brian Hinkle, you want to take us out?
Sure. I think however we're going to judge the Obama administration is going to revolve around the success of his economic reform. And that in turn is going to revolve around the success of his congressional agenda. After they come back from the August recess, if he wants anything to happen on that front, he's going to have to push cap and trade, and he's going to have to push health care.
All right.
You know, and with the split between the progressives and the blue dogs, it'll be tough.
Great analysis from Brian Hinkle, also Pat Gallagher, Tracy Rousey, Alice Craft Kearney. That's four voters, all right? We can't say anything necessarily definitive, but what do you got on the scorecard?
Well, you'll have to bear with me. It's a little unscientific.
It's totally unscientific. There is no science there whatsoever.
Well, with Patsy, rather, it weighs it down. So these folks give him, on average, around a B-.
And that's two who are kind of drifting away and two who are staying with him. So, you know, on the pass-fail, I guess it's two and two.
So we have had this little roundtable, but we want to hear from you, and we've already heard from one of our listeners. Nancy writes in to say, are you kidding? It's 6 months bailing on Obama because he hasn't managed to dig us out of this bottomless pit that we, Bush and Wall Street, co-enabled ourselves into? We got to pay the piper, folks. It's our fault, not his. Suck it up.
All right, we'll
strong
give him another 6 months.
Strong feelings from Nancy.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MY-TAKE.
869-8253.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, asking what is responsibility in this day and age. Everybody has their own opinion, discussions, and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning, everyone. John Hockenberry here with Amy Holmes. Big news in the music world, kind of a detective story, Ms. Holmes. I guess I'm your Watson. Big news in the music world. It's a classical music world, but let's set it in context a little bit. All right, what have we found? Buried in some box of old magnetic tapes, a recording from long before Elvis Presley, of a 7-year-old Carl Perkins in a never-before-heard version of his song, Blue Suede Shoes.
One for the money, two for the show, three to get ready, now go cat go, don't you?
Listen to him, unseasoned, a 7-year-old Carl Perkins. Well, of course, it would be huge if we did find something like that, and of course, that's a total fake. We put that together with our talented news producer, MJ Davis. But this music from a 7-year-old is absolutely real. Piano piece in G being performed by Florian Biersack on the harpsichord, recorded by the Mozart Society. Okay, maybe Mozart was 8 when he wrote this, but it's one of 2 pieces of music that have been in possession of the International Mozarteum Foundation since 1864, and its research department director, Dr. Ulrich Leisinger, was responsible for identifying these 2 pieces as authentic Wolfgang Amadeus Mozart. He joins us from Salzburg, Austria. Good morning, sir.
How are you doing?
And congratulations. Also with us here in the studio is our friend Terrence McKnight, host of WNYC's Evening Music. First of all, Mr. Leisinger, how challenging was it to identify this music?
Well, this was a great moment. We checked carefully for all the pieces within this volume of Mozart, from the Mozart family, and when I got the feeling that these might be pieces by the young Mozart, this was really an exciting moment, and we had to do quite some extra work to make it sound and proof, so that we can now say with almost certainty these are pieces by the young Mozart.
Hmm. So Terrence McKnight here in the studio, it seems like there's sort of 3 Mozarts you get in the enormous body of work that Mozart has. There's the little kid stuff, and it seems like this is an example of that. There's the absolute brilliant genius stuff, and then there's the stuff he was writing to pay the bills because he was a desperate sort of financially composer throughout most of his life. What do you hear in this music?
Well, in this music, now that we know that it's Mozart's, you really get a sense of the direction that he was going. I mean, this kid was about 8 years old. He was probably on tour when he wrote this music, and his father was really trying to show Europe his genius. So you get a sense, when you compare this to other music that's in this same book, you get a sense of really how advanced he was as an improviser and how his thoughts start to come together just in terms of, his arrangements or his voicing. And so you really get a sense of the direction that he's going into.
And let's listen to a clip from the 2nd piece that was identified by Ulrich Leisinger. Here it is. It's called Concerto Movement in G, also on the harpsichord. So Ulrich Leisinger, this music was not written actually for the harpsichord, was it? It was written for the more modern instrument, the forte piano, which was the very early beginnings of the piano as we know it, right?
No, we think that it was actually a harpsichord piece because
really?
The Mozart family did not yet own a fortepiano of their own, and on their grand tour in places like Paris and Brussels or where they were, the harpsichord was still the favorite instrument, and perhaps in London they really learned to know the first modern pianos.
Professor, the pieces have long been in the possession of the foundation. Why now did you make this discovery?
Yeah, this is really related to the story of a facsimile edition where we prepared a careful study of everything that's contained in Nannerl's music book, the book that Leopold set up for his 8-year-old daughter for keyboard lessons, and where the young Mozart also wrote in or had his earliest pieces written in. And since Nannerl's music book is celebrating, so to speak, its 250th anniversary this year, this was the time we were really working hard on this manuscript, and so we can come up with this news.
Well, first of all, congratulations. I'd like to extend my congratulations also. But I'm wondering, now you were the first person to kind of identify, you know, aha, this might be Mozart. I'm wondering what gave, like, your predecessors pause about this being Mozart's score.
Yes, the piece is without an author's name within the Nannerl Notenbuch, and it has been regarded as a fairly weird piece, so there are other people around who confirm that this piece somehow is outside of the typical repertoire of Salzburg of the day. And now we really looked at the handwriting, and it looked as if this was a composing score by Leopold, because there are quite a number of corrections. On the other hand, from the little what you have heard, this is not the music that a very experienced composer would have written. So there's something strange with the music, and this combination of the script of Leopold and music which is, so to speak, younger than Leopold, that fits exactly the situation of the very young Mozart, who was able to play nicely on the piano but could not yet write music himself.
Well, Dr. Ulrich Leisinger, Director of the Research Department of the International Mozarteum Foundation, thanks so much for that and congratulations. And let's listen now. So, Terrence, it's young. That's how they identified it, Ulrich Leisinger says. It's also classic Mozart. When you hear this piece, what other Mozart comes to your mind? Don Giovanni?
maybe the seats of Don Giovanni are in this. I mean, you really get a sense of perhaps of the voicings that he uses in his concertos. I mean, the simplicity of that repeated kind of bass line, dum, 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 dum. I mean, this shows up. I mean, and if we listen to enough of this, you'll start to hear like shades of Sebastian Bach. So you get a sense that, you know, that he was either studying or that he encountered some of Bach's music. In fact, on this tour, he encountered Bach's son. And so and some of Bach's son's music is incorporated in this book for his sister, this music book for Nannerl, this comes from.
1 foot in the Baroque and definitely 1 foot in all that came after the Romantic era and everything. Wolfgang Amadeus Mozart, he already had 600 pieces. He's got 2 more. Terrence McKnight, thanks so much.
Thank you, John.
Our friend Terrence McKnight, host of WNYC's Evening Music, on 2 more pieces of Mozart discovered in Salzburg. Thank you, Wolfgang. Now, a quick look at some of the morning's news.
Well, first, what were you composing at age 8? Incredible.
Right. Variations on Twinkle, Twinkle, Little Star, which is also Mozart.
The White House says today that cash for clunkers will run out of money unless the Senate refills its coffers.
And coming up on The Takeaway, the hardline Iranian government puts 100 election protesters on trial. What does it mean? We'll find out.
The Takeaway is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org and by the Skoll Foundation, supporting social entrepreneurs around the world. Uncommon heroes dedicated to the common good. Learn more at skoll.org.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual Insurance, offering home, auto, and life insurance products to individuals and families who put a premium on doing the right thing. More information at libertymutual.com or 1-800-4-LIBERTY. Responsibility. What's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway.
I'm Amy Holmes, in all week with John Hockenberry. John, two major events are happening this week. We've been reporting on them all morning long. The first is Iran swearing in President Ahmadinejad after a month of the month of the disputed elections and 6 weeks of violent protests. The second major event is a surprise mass trial that many are calling a show trial. About 100 election protesters are being brought up on charges.
Well, the hard line continues there in Iran, absolutely.
Indeed. We have with us Robert Wirth, Beirut bureau chief of our partner, the New York Times, joining us to discuss these recent developments. Robert, thank you for joining us.
Nice to be with you.
So it's my understanding that this came as a major surprise to the Iranian public, these mass trials. Can you tell us what's going on?
Yeah, it came as a surprise actually to the defendants as well. Apparently they did not know what was happening until they were led into the courtroom. And basically, the government had announced that 20 people would be tried starting Saturday. Instead, we got over 100. They were brought into a great big courtroom. Photographs were distributed later. A huge marble-floored, high-ceilinged room. And the prosecutors read out some charges which were extraordinary in the sense that they were not just criminal charges. They were a kind of a indictment of the entire reform movement. It named all kinds of people. They said there was a vast, multi-year conspiracy aimed at, you know, creating a velvet revolution. That's the phrase they always use.
And what kind of sentences could these folks be facing?
It's very hard to tell right now. There's a kind of broad conspiracy charge that they have used in previous trials like this, which in theory can bring the death penalty, but in those cases usually has brought prison sentences, fairly substantial prison sentences. But then often those sentences are significantly reduced by appeals courts.
Well, this is certainly a story we're going to be watching very closely as these trials are underway. You were just listening to Robert Wirth, Beirut bureau chief for The New York Times, our partner.
And joining us now, New York Times columnist Roger Cohen, whose piece on Iran and the future of U.S.-Iranian relations appeared over the weekend in the New York Times. Roger joins us from Rio de Janeiro in Brazil. First of all, good morning, Roger.
Good morning, John.
It seems to me that there are three things to really focus on here in this continuing aftermath for the disputed elections in Iran. The Obama administration came into office suggesting that it was interested in bilateral engagement with the Iranians. Then it sort of said, as the aftermath and the unrest continued in Tehran and elsewhere in the aftermath of the elections, that it wanted the Iranians to sort out the political future there. And finally, as recently as last week, the Obama administration says that this offer to have bilateral talks will close in September. Robert Gates, the defense secretary, and Hillary Clinton both indicating that. Is that enough of an engagement? They call this a policy of engagement. It doesn't sound that way to me.
Well, John, the Bush policy of consigning Iran to the axis of evil did not work, and that was the premise on which the Obama administration went in, knowing that some kind of contact with Iran seems essential if you're going to have a successful withdrawal from Iraq, if you're going to advance Israeli-Palestinian peace talks, given Iran's influence over Hamas and Hezbollah. And it just makes sense strategically to reach out to Iran. That said, you've now had no response from the Iranians to this outreach for several months, and you've had this brutal clampdown following the disputed June 12 election. And all that is leading the Obama administration to think again. But let's be clear, the alternatives are not attractive. If this outreach fails, what are you going to do about Iran's advancing nuclear program?
Roger, this is Amy Holmes here. You have a big piece in the New York Times this weekend that went over, got into this in great detail. I direct our listeners to go read it. But you say that Obama's outreach, his overtures to the Middle East, actually may have contributed to the conflict in Iran.
Well, I think it unsettled the regime. I think it was very easy for President Ahmadinejad to deal with President Bush. A radical White House stimulated, in a way, Ahmadinejad to dismiss the United States as the arrogant power, and this played quite well around the world. On the other hand, the offer of engagement from the Obama administration was unsettling. A pillar of the revolution ever since 1979 in Iran has been anti-Americanism, has been a ritual death to America at Friday prayers. And most Iranians, unlike in many other countries in the Middle East, are very pro-American. So the question for the regime is, 30 years after the revolution, do they really still need this pillar that they've used for all this time, or could they do what China did in 1972, and that is normalize relations with the United States while at the same time maintaining their system? And there, the Iranian revolutionary establishment is extremely divided, and that's one reason why this is so unsettling.
Well, it seems like it's a question for two regimes at the very least. I mean, the irony is that just at the moment that death to America is no longer completely tenable and a safe position for Iranian politicians, it does appear that Barack Obama will be forced to take a position on these government crackdowns in Iran. He said right after the election that basically let's let the Iranians decide. Let's not get into a situation where we can be accused of regime change like back in 1953. But all of a sudden, it seems as time goes on, the Obama administration will be under some pressure to basically criticize the human rights and the lack of sort of judicial equity post-election.
Well, John, I think the president, out of excessive caution, was a couple of days behind the curve throughout the extraordinary uprising. Remember, 3 million people in the streets on the Monday immediately after the election, and I was among them there, and it was one of the most powerful, moving things I've ever witnessed. And out of concern that he might be seen as meddling, given all the poisonous history between Iran and the United States, the president was slow to criticize the Iranian regime for this very brutal crackdown. I try to make a distinction here. I think the president should be very forthright in criticizing the human rights abuses in Iran. He said he would do this in his inaugural. Human rights stand at the center of the Obama administration program. And that's one thing. The other is, I suspect that the president's own intimate conviction is that this election was fraudulent and that therefore this government is illegitimate. There's a lot of evidence of that. However, I think he's been right to be very careful on that front, say nothing, and keep the offer of engagement on the table. That said, going forward, it's going to become more and more difficult to keep this offer out there unless Iran responds soon.
Very quickly, just a couple of seconds, Roger Cohen. If they withdraw the offer, does that essentially signal a failure in engaging the Iranians on the nuclear issue?
It does. It means a return, in essence, to trying to ratchet up sanctions. And given the attitudes of Russia and China toward Iran, that's going to be very difficult.
Roger Cohen, New York Times columnist, talking about the situation in Iran. We didn't even get to talk about the story of three American hikers detained in Iran. Swiss diplomats are trying to meet with those three American hikers being held. No word on whether the Iranian government will allow this meeting to take place. And coming up, are you taking your vacation? If you're an American, chances are you're not. Why and what does it mean? Coming right up.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Amy Holmes.
And I'm John Huckenberry.
So, John, do your kids get outside to play?
Oh,
do they?
Yes.
They climb trees, they build forts.
Out of the house, guys. Nice day today.
Well, unfortunately, though, two new studies show that millions of other children have disturbingly low levels of vitamin D, potentially increasing their risk for bone problems, heart disease, even diabetes. The findings come as the National Academy of Sciences prepares this week to review the federal government's official guidelines for the recommended daily intake of vitamin D. Joining me now is the author of one of those studies, Dr. Michal Melamed of Albert Einstein College of Medicine in New York. Thank you for joining us.
Good morning.
So what is the big risk for not getting enough vitamin D? What do parents need to worry about?
So one thing that parents definitely need to worry about is the risk of rickets. you know, I do, I'm an adult nephrologist, but I did this research with Dr. Juhi Kumar, who's a pediatrician, and she, you know, is more attuned to kids' problems. And rickets is definitely a bone disease that kids with low vitamin D levels get. Other things that potentially they could be at risk for are diabetes, as you said, high blood pressure, cardiovascular disease, and actually a variety of different cancers. Now, all of that data was seen in adults mostly, but we don't know if kids already start out with such low levels and have low levels for a very long time, if it isn't corrected, they could potentially develop those diseases earlier.
Dr. Melamed, are there early warning signs that parents might take notice of before this, you know, turns into a full-blown problem like bone disease, heart disease, and so forth?
So it's hard to tell. I think some kids may complain of bone pains, but, you know, kids complain of bone pains anyways. So really, if parents are very nervous about it, they can always go to their pediatrician and have their child's vitamin D level checked. There are certain groups that are more at risk, so people with darker skin, kids with darker skin color, and older children, so adolescents, are definitely at much higher risk than the younger and the lighter skin children.
Doc, quickly, Doc, is the test really simple? Is it a blood test or is it something?
It's just a blood test.
Okay.
So, of course, you know, the culprits that come to mind that's causing this is the television and video games, all these things that keep kids indoors.
Yes. We actually found that kids who watched more than 4 hours of TV a day had 60% higher risk of having low vitamin D levels.
And is 4 hours a typical amount, or is that considered sort of on the big end of the spectrum?
Yeah, there were actually a fair number of kids who watched that much TV.
So what should parents listening to this, what should they do?
So one simple thing to do is to be aware of vitamin D. So have kids drink their milk, potentially have kids take a vitamin supplement. If your kids go outside for 1 or 2 hours a day, that's fine. They don't need to take their supplement that day. But if they're inside during the winter, those might be the days to take the supplements. And also, you know, judicious sun use is good, 10 to 15 minutes a day, but then be sure to put the sunblock on.
Indeed. Thank you, Dr. Michal Melamed, for joining us this morning on this important study. You were just listening to Dr. Melamed of the Albert Einstein College of Medicine in New York, who helped conduct these studies. And get your kids outside playing. It's good for them.
Sunshine on my shoulders makes me happy.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, examining the practice of renting dogs to people who desire canine companionship when visiting a new city. Who does it really comfort, and who does it exploit? Discussions and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Coming up in just a minute, are you taking your vacation? Have you planned any kind of break this summer? Well, if not, you're not alone. We'll take a look at why some workers are being forced to take unpaid time off while others are skipping vacation time altogether. That's coming up. But first, a look at some of the news stories we're following for you this morning.
Thanks, Amy. First of all, well, cash for clunkers may be dead.
It's authorized through November 1st, but if we don't get the $2 billion from the Senate to match it up with what the House passed, we would have to suspend the program.
They need $2 billion to keep the program going. Automakers say it has spurred sales. President Obama will be in Virginia today to kick off the new GI Bill. This one covers costs for veterans, or if they choose to opt out, the benefits could go to their kids or spouses. Amy?
House GOP leader John Boehner is speaking out against a White House plan to create a joint prison and court complex here in the United States for suspected terrorists. A spokesperson for Boehner called it, quote, ill-conceived. In international news, a town in China's northwest is quarantined after a second person died of pneumonic plague there. That's right, it sounds like that medieval disease. The disease is related to the bubonic plague, though a deadlier strain. But unlike in the 1300s, it can be treated with antibiotics.
look at some of the stories, a quick look at the markets. They're holding on to gains on Wall Street. The market opened just about 20 minutes ago, and oil is on fire, up about $2 a barrel. That's a look at some of the stories we're following today.
So many of you, you're in your cars, you're driving to work right now as you listen. Well, here at The Takeaway, Monday morning means talking about those work issues. And today, we're tackling a tough one, the issue of vacations. Right now, we have two sort of contradictory things going on in the economy when it comes to vacation time. Huge numbers in America are on furlough, that's forced unpaid time off, while others are skipping vacation altogether. We have three people here to discuss this issue of vacation time. Are Americans taking enough? In the studio is Eric Berridge, co-founder and CEO of Blue Wolf Global IT Services, Carrie Henley, here from New Haven, Connecticut. But first, we're joined by Eric Jones, director of IT at iPass, an IT company from Chapel Hill, North Carolina. Eric, you're one of the 86% of people who did not take a vacation last year. What are you waiting for?
Oh, that's a very difficult question. Basically, I'm pretty much a workaholic. I am very fortunate in that I am employed in an economy like this, and I'm working in a field that's very interesting, and I'm doing something that I like to do. And my employer has offered me a significant amount of flexibility in when and how I do my work. So therefore, since that combined with the fact that I'm also single means that I've had really less need, I suppose, to take the old traditional 3-, 4-, 5-day vacation getting away from work. I'm able to take shorter, briefer periods
So how much vacation do you take for yourself?
Well, very, very little. In fact, right now I am maxed out in the number of vacation hours my company allows me to have.
So, Eric, what are you going to do? What are you going to do about those dark circles under your eyes there, pal, huh?
Well, I usually like ice water first thing in the morning right underneath the eyes. I think that helps a tremendous bit. But since I'm an IT person, I tend to stay closed in my office anyway, so I don't really worry about that too much.
Thanks, Eric. Stay with us. I want to bring in writer Carrie Henley, who knows a little bit about this. She writes about vacations. She's director of the board for the Women and Family Life Center, and she joins us from North Haven, Connecticut. Carrie, you recently wrote an article about Americans and how we just don't take enough time off. We don't unplug from our electronic world of being bombarded, you know, with our iPods and our email. But you wrote this article while you were on vacation. You didn't unplug. What's going on?
That's right. Good morning, Amy. Thank you for having me on. Yeah, I have to confess, I'm a mother of four, and I'm a writer, and I run my own business. So I can relate to that experience of when you finally have your long-anticipated vacation that you can't completely unplug, that there still was work that needed to be done, and my brain was not functioning all that well on vacation. So I thought that's what I should write about, is vacation and the stress that sometimes can occur when you're trying to take time off. You're spending a lot of money, you're going to wonderful places, but you're still have that edge that you can't quite let go.
Do you think this is an American thing? I mean, this is sort of a perennial discussion about how Americans can't take vacations. Is it just in our sort of national character?
I think it is, Amy. I think we're unique that Americans take the fewest amount of vacation times of almost any other developed country in the world. And there's 137 countries behind us, ahead of us, who have mandated vacation time. So our government isn't mandating it, and yet we also aren't taking them.
And we're the greatest country in the world.
But we're all exhausted. So Eric Berridge, there you hear it. Eric Jones says all you got to do to forget about vacation, just put ice water under your eyes, pal. That works. What's your vacation plan at your company?
Well, we don't actually have one. We have at Blue Wolf, we have what we call a no vacation policy. And when we hire people, sometimes they can take that the wrong way to mean that they're not allowed to take any vacation. For us, the reality is it's all about personal accountability. And we encourage our employees to take as much vacation as they possibly can while still getting their jobs done. We don't track vacation. We don't have a vacation system. And we encourage...
You don't babysit your employees?
We don't babysit our employees. You know, we probably have people that take 5 or 6 weeks a year. We probably have people that take much less than that. We bank on the fact that the American character is a hardworking, character that will do the right thing. So we try to take an adult version of vacation.
Now, be warned, you might get a flood of resumes after
that sometimes
people
happens.
Hear this, yeah. How can you afford to do this? How does it work?
Well, a lot of it's just having a good dialogue with your manager and understanding what needs to get done in a 4 to 6 week period of time and getting your work done. And if your work's done, you can go and take off.
And are you able to track your workers' productivity to make sure that this policy is, you know, maximizing your bottom line?
Yeah, for the most part. I mean, again, it comes down to that dialogue.
You
that
sound
the
very
has
relaxed.
Yeah,
sure
I don't does. Have any. I don't have any bags under my eyes.
No, and he absolutely doesn't. You go to our website. Maybe we'll get a picture up there just to show you. Well, Carrie Henley, does something like this scale up as a way for like larger companies to actually have a legitimate vacation policy that encourages people to take more time off and yet still keeps the mission of the company on track?
It does, and I think that what Eric's done at Blue Wolf is an example of the innovation of the future for HR companies, and what he's done for a smaller company has been duplicated very successfully at big-name companies we all know, like Best Buy, has a results-only work environment policy where the workers can be free to work anywhere, anytime. So come to work, go home, whatever you want to do, they don't care as long as the work gets done. Netflix is another company that has the same no and un policy. They don't keep track of sick days, vacation days, and yet both of these companies are extremely successful, and they have very high employee satisfaction rate.
So, Carrie, what about the recession, though? We know that prices are being slashed. They're way down at hotels, airlines. The travel industry is doing everything they can to entice people to go on these vacations, but at the same time, Americans are losing their jobs. They're worried about their income staying steady. Can Americans afford to take advantage of these opportunities?
It's a tricky one. In some ways, we have to step back and take a look at the amount of stress we're under from the recession and can we afford not to. Already, it's estimated $300 billion a year is the cost of the illnesses we have from stress.
Wow.
So there's two ways to look at it, that how much is it going to cost us by not stepping back from that frenetic, crazy pace and finding a way to do it that might be more affordable, like camping?
I've got a quick question then for Eric Jones. Buddy, do you have a hobby? Come on.
No.
Do you want a girlfriend?
No, I don't.
No girlfriend, no hobby?
Now, you can argue whether that is a cause or an effect or whether there's a little bit of both involved there, I think, probably.
All right, everybody in America, stop what you're doing. Let's get a hobby for Eric Jones or a girlfriend. Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org. Eric, you know, we're praying for you, buddy.
Well, I don't want to make it sound like I'm, you know, about to jump out of a window here. Things are pretty good. And I just wanted to say, in addition to your other two guests, that their model of approaching vacations is definitely something I am seeing more and more in the organizations we are working with, as in less of an emphasis on tracking hours per se, and more of a results-oriented focus. You know, take the time off you need when you need it. Just get done what we need done by the time we need it done.
Great stuff, everybody. I want to thank all of my guests for joining us this morning. That was Carrie Henley, Director of the Board at the Women and Family Life Center in North Haven, Connecticut. Eric Jones, Director of IT at iPass, an IT company and someone who apparently never leaves his desk. And Eric Barrage, Co-Founder and CEO of Blue Wolf Global IT Services. Thank you.
And they're all on vacation. We have a deadline sort of every morning. The Obama administration, 6 months into the administration, what grade do you give it?
Good morning, Troy calling from Dakota. I have to give Obama a grade of D, as in, please slow down and stop trying to pile on the debt.
Troy is tough. Here's your takeaway, also with a bit of a grade.
He's shown himself to be no different than every other politician. He is very good at telling you what you want to hear. As Goldman Sachs records their highest profits in history, the average person in this country is afraid to spend money because we're on the abyss of a financial crisis.
Some of our listeners are tough. What do you think?
I'm Amy Holmes.
I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org and by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is The Takeaway.
The
There's a lot going on right now. Mounting economic inequality, threats to democracy, environmental disaster, the sour stench of chaos in the air. I'm Brooke Gladstone, host of WNYC's On the Media. Want to understand the reasons and the meanings of the narratives that led us here, and maybe how to head them off at the pass? That's On the Media's specialty. Take a listen wherever you get your podcasts.